Mr. Cooper, will you be sworn in, please? Hello, Mr. Cooper.
Hello.
Are you appearing here today and testifying under oath voluntarily?
Yes.
Have you been paid by anyone for your testimony other than the expenses of coming to the city of Clearwater?
No.
Do you have a lawsuit against the Church of Scientology?
Yes.
Does the Church of Scientology have a lawsuit against you?
Yes.
18. How many? 18?
18.
And for the record, the commissioners may remember one of the early exhibits on the purpose of a lawsuit, which was read to harass and discourage and to destroy the person.
Has anyone suggested to you that you should state anything but the truth, or has anyone suggested that you change your testimony for any reason?
No.
How do you defend yourself against 18 lawsuits?
You work day and night as a tort lawyer.
I don't know how you can simply afford it.
I figured out just recently that it's cost over $50,000 just paying legal fees on these suits.
For the record, I haven't received any of that.
I'm just on that again.
Start the beginning in your own words, please.
Okay. I'm a freelance writer. I live in Manhattan. I'm the author of several hundred articles, two of which are about Scientology. I'm also the author of six books, one of which is The Scandal of Scientology. I have been studying Scientology since 1968. The last couple of years, the Scientology...
I don't think they can hear you, Ms. Cooper. They're mentioning the back of the room.
Okay. The last couple of years, the Scientologists have been telling the people of Clearwater that they've changed. And they've been saying this a lot in the last couple of years, and I certainly haven't noticed it. As I said, the 18th lawsuit was just served on me last week. I am being sued now repeatedly by individual Scientologists who, in some cases, I don't even know, sued for supposedly distributing literature at functions I didn't even attend. Part of the purpose in harassing people with lawsuits is to keep deposing them and preventing you from writing or making a living and making you show up in legal depositions. I've been deposed for 19 days total since this started, with I think four more coming up in a couple of weeks. There's also been some other harassment in the past 6 months or so, continued calls to me, calls to my family. The Scientologists find out what people's buttons are, I mean, as they put it, and that is the way to get to them, and they know that a way to upset me is to harass my parents, so they have undergone a great deal of harassment as well as my harassment. They've put out libelous publications about me. They've sent letters saying that I will soon be in prison, and you saw the Operation Freakout and the attempts that had been made to put me in prison. They've sent false reports about me to the Justice Department, the District Attorney's Office, the IRS. As you know, government agencies have to investigate any complaints that they get. So then Scientology sends out a press release that I am under investigation by the Attorney General's Office, and under investigation by the DA, and so on. They have put detectives on me. They have put spies on me. A few months ago, they put an attempted spy on my mother to try to get information about me via her and to fix me up with the woman's son so that they could get direct to me. They've canceled my plane somebody canceled my plane to Florida about a month ago, and that is the third time that's happened to me this year when I was traveling. I'd like to say that this was a very good year compared to the previous years. And I'd like to discuss a little bit what it was like to fight Scientology alone, starting in 1968, because I was the only one who was speaking out. I mean, this is a wonderful thing where there are people speaking out now, but when I started, absolutely nobody else did. And I was the only person from 1968 until 1973. In 1973, Nan McLean joined, and the two of us spoke out publicly. And then in 1976, Gabe Cazares joined, and there were the three of us. When I started in 1968, there was no support from the press, there were no rallies, there were no grand juries looking into Scientology, there were no lawyers like Mike, Mr. Flynn. There was no peer acceptance about what you were doing. There was just no understanding that anything was wrong. It was somewhat like a social group that people were joining, and It had a veneer that everything was going along well, although based on the testimony you've been hearing, you know that these dirty tricks were going on. But if I would say that they were, people thought that I was the one that was making up these things about them. I'd like to give a little background as to how I got interested in the subject. I never was a Scientologist. My basic interest is as a writer. I like investigative things. In addition, I have a master's degree in psychology, and I studied comparative religion at Harvard for a summer. A friend of mine, in 1968, joined Scientology, and he ended up in a mental institution. I'm not saying that one caused the other, but it certainly piqued my curiosity. When he escaped, he came to visit me, and he told me that he was Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. And he'd been a pretty normal person before then. I then called our mutual friend who had gotten him in and said, he thinks he's Christ. And my friend said, well, maybe he really is. So I thought, well, this bears some investigation. I went in and took their weekend course. During the time, I wandered away from the group where they were teaching the particular TRs, as they call them. And I came upon a list of people who, I don't remember for sure if it was a fair game order, but I think it was, because these people were being declared enemies of mankind. And it was very odd terminology. I remember one woman's name was on there, and they declared her an enemy of mankind for pushing five men down a flight of stairs. And I thought, how could she do that? I mean, it just didn't ring quite true. And I decided to contact some of these people when I came home. And I think I took about five names, the five top people. And every one of them had an unlisted number, disconnected phone. Well, this is 1968. The people who was attracting, 22, 23 years old. You just by chance, among a group of people, are not going to hit five unlisted numbers unless there's a reason for people to go and unlist their number. So it began to bother me that, you know, was this so-called respectable church perhaps harassing people? And in that one weekend, I had noted that they had lied about certain things, and I wondered about a church lying to people. And I decided to look in the library and see if I could get any information, any books. And I discovered that all stories had been clipped out of every single magazine pertaining to Scientology. And I wondered whether this church was actually perhaps possibly stealing things. Well, I spent the next couple of years doing research into Scientology. And my first article came out in December of 1969. That's also the month that I received my first death threat. And then a number of mysterious events occurred, both then and during the time within the next year and a half until my book came out. I was followed on several occasions. We found a phone tap on my phone. I was being multiply sued already at that time. People kept calling me and trying to take me out, and it seemed like people were trying to get to me. And this went on for four unpleasant years, including four lawsuits, one of which was for somebody else's book. And when that happened, I got really annoyed, and I became... I became the first person to sue them for harassment. And this was very shocking to them, because Hubbard had actually written that an enemy, that no one would ever sue Scientology, that they had too much to hide and that people were criminals who ever attacked the church, and therefore we would just sort of wither away and die. And so they then decided, as we learned later, and I'm going to discuss this later, at that time that they would have to get me and they would have to silence me. Because after my book came out, I began to receive very, very disturbing calls. And the type of things that you've been hearing for the last 3 days were the type of things that people would call and tell me were mysterious things happening to them, thefts, all kinds of very unpleasant things. And yet everybody had this sort of paranoid feeling, and they were afraid to speak out. People were very afraid to speak out. And yet when enough people who don't know each other tell you the same thing happening to them, you begin to realize that something is going on. Well, about October of 1972 started the big campaign to finally silence me or attempt to stop me. That month I received the second of what was ultimately to be five anonymous, absolutely disgusting smear letters about me. Okay. This particular one called me a part-time prostitute, and you can imagine how upsetting it is to open up something like that and read it. And during the same period of time, there were a large number of attempts to get into my apartment, which was on the ground floor of the building that I lived in at the time. It was not well guarded. I was quite concerned. I received a tremendous number of really disgusting calls. I remember one day counting 11 calls. Remember that I work as a freelance writer. That means that if I get upsetting calls and I'm unhappy, it's very hard to just pick up and continue writing what you're working on. A lot of nuisance calls then and over the years, just this sort of, you pick up the phone and someone says, oh, what are you doing? And, you know, you got to hang up, and then they call back, and so you have to take the phone off. Excuse me, you have to take the phone off the hook, and then if you're trying to interview somebody, they can't call you back. Well, I finally decided I was going to move to a higher security apartment, even though I really could not afford to do so at the time. I moved on December 15th. On December, the person who took over the apartment was my second cousin. We bore a physical resemblance, but basically because we're about the same age, and she was very petite, and we both had short brown hair at the time. And a series of mysterious circumstances occurred. The important thing was that she opened up the door to someone who had flowers and rang my bell. And I was no longer living there, although my name was still on the door. And Eddie Walters told you about R245, and you've heard of the policy. When Joy opened the door to get these flowers, he unwrapped the flowers, and there was a gun in it. And he took the gun, and he put it at Joy's temple. And he cocked the gun, and we don't know whether it misfired, whether it was empty, and it was a scare technique, or what happened. But somehow or other, the gun did not go off. And he started choking her, and she was able to break away, and she started to scream, and the person ran away. And she called the detective, and he said, it's a very odd attack, because there doesn't seem to be any motive for it. And there was no attempted rape, there was no attempted robbery, and why should somebody just suddenly try to kill her? About a week or two later at my new apartment, I received a visit from the FBI, and they informed me that the public relations person for Scientology had claimed to have received a couple of bomb threats and had named me as somebody likely to send bomb threats. So I didn't take the whole visit very seriously, and the FBI asked me if I would mind being fingerprinted, and I said that I would not and was fingerprinted. At the same time, my cousin Joy's boyfriend had been very, very upset about what happened, and he said, boy, you better let your Scientology spies know that you have moved and where you are, because I don't want anything to happen to her again. And I did, and shortly thereafter, in my to my new building, half the tenants, which is approximately 300 tenants in the building, received a very, very disgusting anonymous smear letter about me, trying to get me kicked out of the apartment and saying that I had venereal disease, that I had sexually molested little children. The only thing that was true in the letter was my age, which was not something I wanted known anyway. And it was very, very embarrassing. I was walking through the building, and I heard people talking about me in the elevator, and I was just sort of slinking along, and I was really... A month later, my parents received an anonymous smear letter about me, accusing me of practicing sexual perversions with their clergymen. These were not very good months, so when I was called before a grand jury around this time, at least I didn't think this was anything very serious and did not bother to retain a lawyer. Had very little money because I had used all my money to move to this more expensive, higher security apartment. And when I got there, they told me that I was the target of an investigation into the bomb threat. And I went and had to hire a lawyer. And every lawyer wanted, the least we could get was $5,000 retainer, which in those years was like paying $10,000, today. And to suddenly have to pay this sum of money and find out that you're in serious trouble, and no one would, the government would not tell my lawyers what the evidence was against me. They wouldn't show me the letters. Anyway, finally I went before the grand jury, and I tried to answer every question as truthfully as I could, and I never took the Fifth Amendment. And they kept asking me again and again, did you ever see this letter? Did you ever touch it? Do you know who might have? And I said, incidentally, yes, but I suspected that Meisler might have sent it to himself because we'd had some unpleasant confrontations in the press. And then they asked me to step outside of the room, and when I came in, I knew I was in very serious trouble. They asked me what my Social Security number was, whether I was on drugs, and did I realize what I had said so far. And again, they asked me the same series of questions. And then they said, well, Ms. Cooper, if you've never touched this letter before, could you tell us how your fingerprint got on it? And I felt like a grand piano had just hit me on the head. I fainted sitting up. The whole room just turned upside down. I didn't know what to do. And then, of course, the lawyers wanted more money. And on May 19th, 1973, I was indicted on 3 counts of sending bomb threats through the mail. 2 counts were for the 2 letters. 1 was for perjury, for saying before the grand jury that I hadn't done it and that I thought that this public relations person might have done it. On May 29th, 10 days later, I was arrested and I was arraigned. The next 8 months were a terrible, terrible nightmare in my life that I still feel sometimes that I suffer from to this day. I had 15 years in jail over my head, $15,000 in fines. I was petrified of going to jail, more so perhaps because of my small frame and the fact that I heard that women's federal prisons were rough places. I risked having my career totally destroyed because, and I had been successful, and as a freelance writer, what editor is ever going to give an assignment to someone who's been indicted or convicted for sending bomb threats to someone they exposed? I was very concerned about the indictment and the trial coming out in the newspapers. The public does not know the difference between indict and convict, and they think that if you're on trial for something that you must have done it, or where there's smoke, there's fire. I felt that it would be terrible public humiliation that every person I ever knew in New York to read the details of the trial and these accusations. I was most concerned about my parents, who had adopted me when I was 6 years old, and how humiliating it would be for them and their friends to have to explain and to go through a trial like this. During this period of time, I went into a terrible, terrible depression, and a number of my friends, which I can't blame them for, did not stick by me. I was depressing to be with. I had been seeing a man for 5 years and had intended to marry him, and he left as a result of my depression.